Welcome to the You Catastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. Welcome back. We've had a bit of a longish hiatus because 2020 is sort of the gift that keeps on giving. I'm Joel, joined as always by Dave here, and we are back to recording at a distance. I'm currently staring at Dave's face through FaceTime as he looks upon me. This is mediated technology that I don't like because I prefer authentic real Dave in front of me. But you know, in New South Wales at the moment, we have this little bit of a mini outbreak. I say mini outbreak because by international comparisons, it's very small. By Australian comparisons, it's an existential nightmare that is threatening to cancel Christmas for everyone. So that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, we know what it's pointing to is the problem.
We know what?
We know what it's pointing to in that they don't stay small when this happens.
Right, yeah. So we're recording at a distance. At the moment, there's also people in my house with a cold, so didn't want to give Dave that as an actual Christmas gift. You know, this is about what we're going to be talking about today, actually. We're recording three episodes for your summer listening. The second one we're going to do on Pope Francis's Fratelli Tutti, and the third we're going to do on doubt, in which we explore the depths and madness of David's mind. But for this one, we're going to be talking about 2020, and Dave will explain in a moment. But it was fascinating because we actually, the last big social thing we just did was what I thought would be the capstone on 2020. You know, I thought this was like a Shakespearean play, right? In which it was all crazy leading up to one big wedding. So you and I went to this, wedding, right? We thought this was the end. This was the celebration of our friend Phil and his new bride Imogen. And we had a wonderful time, and it was fantastic, and then we go on to this. So I hope they're still having... Anyway, we should say congratulations to Phil and Imogen. I hope you're having a great time on your honeymoon. And there's two things I need to ask Dave now. One, whenever we've had a listener get married, I've asked Dave to give them one piece of advice. And the other one I need to ask Dave... Well, let's just do that first. Dave, your piece of advice. As someone who's been married since he was 14...
don't get into the weird stuff too quickly. You gotta leave something.
Oh my goodness. Well, judging by the wedding itself, because this goes into my second question. My second question is, as I sat there, I thought, you know, this feels like I'm talking to my students in ways or something where they have no idea what I'm doing when I'm dropping Simpsons references or things like this. I didn't understand a lot of the words that were used, and you did not treat me kindly for this.
You kept on turning to me and saying, "What does it mean to be thirsty for someone?" it was so funny, and I love it that in your mind I'm a 17-year-old, like that I, and I guess I am a bit more up in the youth lingo than you, but it was hilarious that I was your go-to person to try and translate.
So I actually went and asked my 21-year-old cousin. I had like a list of words that I had to have translated for me, and I got the gist. I got a little bit of it from context, but you know, maybe it's best I didn't as well. You know, I just smiled. What is it? Homer Simpson smiling politely.
And your head just
Anyway, it was a wonderful wedding, and we're very happy for Phil and Imogen. So, you know, good things
well
in
done.
2020. Yeah, well done. You did it. What are we doing this episode, David?
So this episode's a bit of a spiritual sequel to an episode that we recorded this time a year ago, which was about celebrating Advent while the world was on fire. So we've had fires.
Yay!
And now we're in plague. And we're basically wanting to do a bit of a review of this year. Based on what did we learn about our political and social order through the pandemic. What did the pandemic kind of highlight for us about the good things and the bad things about society? We're mainly going to be talking about the bad things because it's us. but I, as a way into talking about that, there's a musician that I've been really liking over the last year or so called David Benjamin Blower. He's a British guy. I think he's also got a podcast called the Nomad Podcast, maybe? Anyway, I'm sorry if I got that wrong. I really love his music, and he happens to be someone that like has this strange intersection of philosophical interests that completely align with mine. So he'll talk about Agamben and Walter Benjamin in his music and things like that. And he wrote an article. He wrote an album during lockdown called Apocalyptic Lockdown Blues, which is the name of a track as well. And he had this great couple of verses on that track that are as follows. He says, while we're awaiting and self-isolating, the animals are wandering the streets, where all our scurrying feet used to come and go in our unknown griefs. Scratching and restless behind all the vexes is a beast that waits behind the door. His name is Business as Usual, and he wants it all back the way it was before. Yeah. I think that's a kind of chilling reflection on both the kind of, because the song is about the kind of existential angst that a lot of people experience during lockdown. But then on top of that, we've got the anxiety about, well, we don't want to go back to what has been suspended through the pandemic. We want something else. And so I thought that was a really interesting way into thinking about how to reflect about 2020. What problems has it shown endemic to liberalism? And what might a better business as usual look like? We're going to be mainly talking about problems this episode, but next episode we're going to be talking a bit more, hopefully, as we reflect on Fratelli Tutti. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Sounds wrong.
Look,
Tutti.
You're Irish, I'm Scottish. Let's just go with it.
So basically what we're going to be doing now is just kind of reflecting on some of the kind of taxonomy of woes that we've been presented
with. Well, hopefully we'll have, we'll have some hints at directions. Or even, like, I think there's nothing wrong with doing a taxonomy of woes, because it's sort of like, some people say nihilism is like almost pre-evangelistic in the sense that pointing to, the darkness also refers back to the light, because it gives a sense of, well, we must actually opt for something like peace or hope in the face of such horror, right?
And you were saying something really interesting before about why you love Trump. you were talking about the opportunity that...
Well, in ways it's apocalyptic, right? Trump. So Samuel Moyn has a couple of great pieces on the Trump phenomenon at the end of his time, in which he says, he calls it the Great Evasion, which will be that you have these liberals who want to snap back, right? And so Biden's term, Build Back Better, and now you see all the people that he's bringing into the offices of executive power with him are all basically the same, sort of liberal interventionists and so on, or technocratic people, or people who, in between the Obama and Trump and the now Biden years, they went and worked for Google, for Uber, for this and so on, right? And so, it's kind of like a more of the same mentality. And Moyne is saying, we're losing the opportunity to reflect on what brought about Trump, but also how Trump has really opened up the possibility for alternative ways of thinking as against a sort of moribund democratic order in the United States, right? So this could go in right-wing nationalist ways, and it is in obvious ways as well. But it could also go, Moyne argues, in a kind of progressive internationalist that is nevertheless not interventionist kind of way. Then I think in our context we'd be thinking, some form of post-liberal politics. But even that is quite a contested space at the moment. So I think there is some really fertile thing to be thinking about. We may get more into that in 2021. But to start with here, I think, you're saying what have been the sort of the horrors or the things, the inadequacies or the problems that have been highlighted by the pandemic. I mean, I think we really should start with just absolutely increasing inequality. There is the reality that that I am part of a class of people that can easily work from home, and my life has not been, it's been disrupted, and it's been really rubbish to be stuck in an apartment continually with the two kids, and these sorts of things, and there's been hardships of that kind, but I can continue, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm part of this class of people that you know, all these people in the Australian context, they went off to the Blue Mountains or they went off to Byron Bay and they could do this, right? And then there are another class of people that are essentially serving us. They're the ones that are actually out there doing work and risking themselves to service my life and my lifestyle. So Kate, my wife, pointed out this really fascinating point that apparently in parts of Sydney, cinnamon went out of stock, right? This is outside of the madness of shopping, but cinnamon, because people in a more who had more capacity for luxury goods were buying cinnamon in order to do their great home baking and this sort of thing, right? When you've got some people are going below the breadline, and some people are having to take up more and more precarious work in order to service people like me. So you see this increase in consumption that happens, right? So Amazon, in its third quarter for 2020, its profits are up 37%. It's tripled its profits for this year. Jeff Bezos' fortune has gone up to over $200 billion. All the big tech companies have gone up in value. They've put something like $2.1 trillion on top of their value, right? And this is because they're absorbing all these companies and all these other producers that have been dying in the context of the pandemic, and so you're getting more oligopolies happening. We also have in our context now increasing usage in food banks. So there's a study by Food Bank, an outfit in Victoria, where they're saying that demand for food relief has gone up by 47% during COVID. Yeah. And they identify casual workers and international students as the predominant consumers of this, right? Both classes of people that have been barred from benefit services for unemployment, what we call in Australia, JobKeeper and JobSeeker. So there's a suggestion, this is pretty horrifying, I think, that around one in six international students have been relying on food banks, right? So and this is happening at the same time that some people are actually probably doing quite well out of this, right? Yeah, so it's this complete disparity of narratives. So we got the start of the pandemic and everyone said, oh, the COVID, it attacks anyone. It doesn't care about class. It doesn't this. And that's, you know, true at a sort of epidemiological level, right? But not entirely operates because, you know, I can isolate myself. I can sit back and behind a fortress and do my work and so on, right? Whereas some people actually have to bear the brunt of it.
Yeah. I mean, if we stick with kind of race and class issues for a moment, we haven't talked about race much in this episode, but it's an interesting dynamic with international students because they're both precarious in the sense they're in a precarious position because they're not entitled to benefits, although they are a huge source of revenue for the country. They're also in often in precarious housing situations, so they could be evicted at any point. We'll talk a bit about housing in a sec. But they're also scapegoated as well. So they're treated with suspicion as the source of the plague. And so they're in this horrible situation where they're both the victims, the victims of kind of the pandemic and kind of social racist
and this is actually,
currents as well.
Yeah, this is actually one, you know, if you're thinking about post-Trump.
Oh, and they're also... They're also the people doing gig economy work as well, which has an increased risk of exposure to the virus, I should say.
And death. Yeah, like, there's an interesting series on The Guardian about, you know, all these gig workers who are dying in their roles. Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting, you know, post-Trump possibility about a true authoritarian comes into power, right? So Trump was kind of an ineffectual authoritarian in many ways, right? Yeah. And he didn't actually get much done. You know, he sort of continued certain forms of international bombings of people and then actually drew back from some. But, you know, one form of authoritarianism is to say, as you said, to start scapegoating, right? To define a community now in relationship to its opposition of a friend-enemy distinction. And this is actually some Catholic thinkers are even baptizing that kind of Schmittian view, right?
Schmittian, the friend-enemy distinction.
Yeah, but so Pope Francis, we're going to talk about him next week, but Fratelli Tutti, when he talks about the pandemic, he says, anyone who thinks that the only lesson to be learned is a need to improve what we're already doing or refine existing systems and regulations is denying reality. Because he says what it's actually created, and I think he's right about the pandemic, is an increase in feverish consumerism, he says. New forms, he says, of egoistic self-preservation. Yeah. So he says, for example, we've spent years dismantling, and he's really explicit, dismantling public healthcare systems. And now we face a health crisis, you know?
Yeah.
And then we've spent years of, you know, now just building up our discipline is not to be concerned about, you know, these people as a matter of class and so on, but actually to do what he says, which is egoistic self-preservation. So even now in Australia, when we have this outbreak on the northern beaches in Sydney, you know, we'd had 15 cases today. So it's not huge, but it's significant for Australian context, right? You go to the petrol station, everyone is buying toilet paper again. Yeah. Yeah, it's just mad stuff, right? Like, anyway, and then what happens talking about the gig economy in Australia, we now have this claim for industrial relations, so employment law or industrial relations reform, in which essentially there's some proposal going through for the government to make it easier to make someone a contract worker and to make it easier to define a part-time worker's hours in such a way that you don't have to give them overtime, for example, or to make it easier to claim for an employer that your work is affected by COVID. And therefore, you can undercut what are minimum awards and minimum standards within an industry, right? All of this is pointing to trying to say we need flexibility and agility and all those sort of, you know, new speak you get out of, you know, business councils and so on, right? But actually, it is fundamentally about taking the class of people who have suffered the most in the context of this pandemic and making life harder for them, right? That's what it seems to be doing.
Staying with kind of the economic and the Amazon world for a sec, one thing that I found interesting, which is a kind of, I think Francis deals with this a bit in Fratelli Tutti as well, that one of the things that has been highlighted for us as well is supply chains have become relevant to the public consciousness for the first time in a unique way for a long, long time. So I genuinely think that most people in Australia live with a, you know, cargo cult mentality,
right?
Meaning, you know, the cargo cult being this assumption by people who don't live in capitalist societies, when cargo washes up on the shore, that, you know, if they engage in rituals, that will happen again. And this has often been a source of kind of condescension by people.
It's Western. Like the mystical appearance of goods. They come from nowhere. Yeah. They're just there for you. Yeah.
Yeah, and that you just engage in ritualistic behavior, and that's what brings them about, right? But that's how we operate as well, consciously, unconsciously. We don't know where our goods come from, and we are used to making them appear magically by clicking on buttons. But this year we've actually experienced scarcity for the first time. Like we've wanted things in shops or online, and we haven't been able to get them, and this has caused kind of this real shock for a lot of people. Like even myself. The other day I was like, you know what? I'm going to get a PS5. I'm going to get a PlayStation 5 so I can game even better, with my high school friends, every evening. And you can't get one. They're sold out for months.
Man, this is the real story, isn't it, people? This is the real story of the pandemic.
And no one's thinking about the effect on me, but I know I'm a horrible consumer and things like that, but that's an unusual experience.
Yeah, I think it, right? But actually, that a supply line would break down. I think it's also probably unusual in that it's a certain product and you've experienced it. I think generally speaking, the surprising thing has been there hasn't been that much of a delay. Even in our supermarkets, they're seemingly a restock the next morning and so on. You know, Woolworths and Coles and major supermarket chains in Australia, their profit lines have gone through the roof, right? So we've actually increased our consumption generally, I think. You know,
That's right.
You may be...
My consumption of online shopping was scandalous at the beginning of the situation.
Yeah, because there was both that sense of, oh, I've got to prepare, I've got to bunker down, and also that self-preservation, as Francis points out, this sense of like, uh-oh, we exist in a competitive all-everyone-eats-each-other universe. I better get my share before it's taken by Joe Bloggs down the street, right? Now, I just want to allude to this to sort of round off this part, right? Like, the Archbishop of Canterbury gave a great speech in 2018 to the Trade Union Congress conference, and he says, you know, that this is not an economic decision of the market, right? This is not like some market forces are just determining our fate here. He says it is a failure of common human decency of values. It says no to the common good, solidarity. And God replies, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. It's a great, if you haven't read The Switch before, do. I mean,
it's great. It finishes I think with you can him, watch it as well on YouTube.
Yeah, you can. And it finishes with him basically saying, like, you know, join your union.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, so that just shows, you know, like all these different little things bubbling away. We often don't see it. You know, Dave's busy playing with his PlayStation, right? So who's occluded from our vision here, right? It's certain people are occluded. Gig workers, the disabled, elderly, the poor.
Yeah, and then the people, there's a paper I'm working on at the moment actually about, you know, we are used, people kind of understand, right, that we sacrifice the elderly, we sacrifice people with disabilities and things like that, people understand that. But one of the ways in which we kind of devalue these people is it's the people that we pay to support these people that that demonstrate how unworthy we see these people, right? So we consider the people that we set up to be the most significant person in the life of our neighbor with a disability, who is usually, you know, a Nepalese or Bangladeshi support worker in a residential support place. They are the most sacrificable people in our economy, right? They have horrible working conditions. They are exposed to risk of infection during the pandemic. They're paid very, very badly, and they do very, very dangerous and not very socially valorized work, right? And that demonstrates both the worth that we ascribe to those workers as individuals, but also the people that we that they're there to support as well, because these people are the most important people in these people's lives. And there's this whole class of people that we basically see as expendable. They're an expendable part of the economy, and we dare to call it kind of unskilled labor as well.
Yeah, and beyond our vision. So this is one thing the pandemic's done is it's highlighted aged care.
Yeah.
So we've had to come to grips with that. These are places of severe vulnerability in the context of a pandemic, right? And who has been responsible for the horrible care that takes place? And, you know, we like to say, oh, the government, the federal government, and that's all, you know, there are real problems there, right? But at the same time, we've created a system in which we take our elderly and we put them in these facilities.
Yeah.
You know, and this is and this is not to say that any particular instance where this has happened has, you know, is like, oh, every time it's, because actually it's not clear what your options are, right?
That's right. I mean, my mother was in a nursing home for the last part of her life, and that was a necessity for us. But at the same time, I acknowledge that, like, part of the problem with our society is that
it's a necessity.
We have created that necessity, but also we have diminished natural social solidarities between families, family members, that would provide informal supports necessary to support the elderly, right? So, and this is where I kind of, you know, put on my slightly conservative hat and kind of going, well, actually, part of supporting the elderly is it's supporting the integrity of family relationships. Mm. And that doesn't mean that I'm one of these people that wants to ban divorce or anything like that. I'm just saying that we need to foster natural bonds, and that's one of the things that society should be doing.
I think you're right, but I think you'd also have to think about housing, right? So
that's right,
you know, as in, like, it's
you couldn't what I'm saying is that one of the things that undermines the family is the precariousness that family members experience in both employment and housing and all these things that disperses families, that kind of creates competition amongst families, that, you know, all these different things, which has been, you know, many different religious leaders have talked about at length. But housing, I think, is a really important one to focus on as well for the pandemic, because, you know, one of the things that it's kind of shone a light on in the Australian context is how many renters there are in Australia and how few rights people that are renting have, and with this massive fear of, you know, okay, I lose my income, I'm renting at the moment, if I get made homeless during the pandemic, what the heck happens to me then? And I don't think this is just a problem with the pandemic. Again, I think it's highlighting a problem that already existed, that is that people's housing is precarious. They have no they have no emotional, psychological space to put down roots in a particular location because they are worried that at the turn of the corner, the housing prices will go up and they'll have to uproot and move on because they don't have the income to make sure that they have a capacity to keep living in the area that they've put down roots in and formed communities that where they've sent their kids to school and things like this. This is a real problem. Human beings are made to have roots in a community, whether it's a geographical place or not, but at least to have some sense of security around the place and people that they are going to be spending their life with, whether it's family members or not. This is a real problem, right? And so much of our economy seems to be based on the accumulation and misuse of real estate. So that, you know, you can afford your third freaking yacht.
Wow. Or your investment property that you get tax
and
breaks
land
on.
Land just being held for no social good, right? So just being left empty with no one, while we know that there's a housing crisis, that should be seen as a great immorality that's taking place.
Yeah, which is just something we may come back to, I guess, with Fratelli Tutti, because it's France is it's one of the tables he turns over. Now, I want to take, we don't have too much time, but we're probably actually, we've saved the last part, which is probably the most speculative and maybe even most interesting part for our last, let's say, 10 minutes maybe. So I want to talk about the church in this context.
Yes. So what direction? I've got a few different directions. We don't have a huge amount of time. One of the interesting things that has occurred to us during this pandemic is the suspension of normal religious activities within religious spaces. And the discourse that's gone on around it, but also the regulations that have been set up in place to prevent it. And so it seems to be, and this, I don't want to sound like, you know, your uncle on Facebook complaining about our liberties being taken away, but there does seem to have been an unfair burden placed on religious gatherings against other forms of gatherings.
Okay, so let me give some concrete context. So this is in New South Wales and Sydney especially and so on, right? So I think Dave and I both agree that in the context of a pandemic, actually closing your church is the thing to do for loving your neighbour.
And I would say as well that the state is right to intervene and to make that happen.
When we all left the physical building, we're all in agreement that this is the right thing to do.
Even though it's like, it's a tragedy, right?
Yeah. Because
I'm not one of these people that say, oh, God's not in a building.
No. Go back and listen to our Sacred Spaces episode, right?
Like, that drives me up the wall just as much.
Yeah, no. We talked about this earlier this year around the problems that can come out from churches when they think, oh, it's great to just go online, right? But, okay, so in the New South Wales context, we had a scenario under our health regulations where, for example, if 20 people walked outside of the church and were standing outside the church, one person joined them, making 21, the rector would have to disperse them. Those same 21 people could go across the road to the cafe or the pub and sit down together and dine, right? In the churches, this is when we're dealing with a context of minimal to 0 days of community transmission. You had churches, we could not sing, even though we were four square meters apart, we could not sing. But you could, again, the whole same group could go down to the pub, crowd around a table, sing, you know, I Walk 10,000 Miles, whatever the song is, or yell happy birthday to their heart's content. At the same time, you had these sorts of restrictions on churches. You could have 60,000 people gathering in a stadium to barrack for their favorite team and so on, right? Yeah. Now, the rationale behind this was from saying, oh, you know, in churches, the practices, they're just so loose and people will be hugging and they can't stop touching each other or something like this, right?
Unlike sporting events where everyone is always completely...
So there's a certain arbitrariness that enters into it, right? And I think if you went through the regulations, you could find this in multiple places, but it did raise a question because it kept on being said, well, why are churches being treated like this but not these places like pubs or casinos, right? Casinos. and cafes and so on. And I think, you know, the reason why I find this interesting is because, you know, we're talking about what do we need as a what's the phrase you used, a better business as usual, or you know, to take the terrible Biden phrase, build back better. You know, what do we need to change? And we've been saying, you know, we need an openness to a sense of our common good, where we care for each other and for the ends of every person as a contributor to our society that has the means to contribute to that, and so on. All these sorts of things. And, you know, and we're trying to say that, you know, you need to have some sense that the public ethic could be shifted away from, say, competition of self-preserving individuals to some understanding that we are pursuing a good together. And we think, you know, I think, I'm sure you agree, is that, you know, this is what actually is the Christian narrative provides and these spaces, right? Now, then the difficulty becomes, I think that we're trying to say that this is something that is for the public, right? And even in my book, I start talking about the liberty of churches and all this sort of thing and say none of this will matter if there isn't a commitment to an understanding that this is a good.
That's right.
Gathering of people who do these various things on a Sunday, on a throughout the week, who do, you know, ministries of mercy into the community, who provide services, who do these things, that this is actually central to our political life, right? And if we don't have that commitment, then none of this matters, I don't think, because they will just sort of fritter away. And so then this raises the question, right? Because in this context of this pandemic, this has been one of the disheartening things to me. If I'm right that there has been this arbitrariness of treatment, what it effectively is saying is, it's what Carl Pagliani, when he talks about in the book The Great Transformation, he says we've shifted to a society that is embedded in the economy. So we're now economic man, right? We're directed towards economic ends as opposed to the economy used to be built out of the social ties between persons.
Animal laborans is what Hannah Arendt would say.
Right. And then you could take it a step further than Pagliani and say, well, to be an economic man in our context is not just about, you know, industry in the sense of you're a laborer, and that's actually what we're trying to focus on. No, it's about producing frivolity, right? Because frivolity,
which is the fair rent, is the same thing,
right? It stirs the economy,
you know, it
generates the economy. So you can go to the casino, you can go to the pub, but you can't do these things in a church, right?
Yeah,
and so this makes me think, yeah, it's kind of depressing. It's a sort of depressing moment to my mind, where I'm thinking, how do you begin to articulate then in this kind of society that this is such a good that is fundamental to our political life?
So I completely agree. But I guess a further question is, what type of good is it? So, and my problem is that not only do we perhaps not identify religion and religious practice as a good within society, but we have no way of identifying what type of good it is and how to weigh it against other goods as well, right? So how do you weigh in a kind of a risk management sense, you know, the risk to health versus the risk to imperiling one's soul kind of thing, is a difficult question. And so one way of thinking about this, right, if you ask the average Australian, right, why do you open sporting events and not religious events, their answer would be more people care about sport, right? So it's a preference utilitarian argument that the preferences, that the balance of preferences is for the opening of pubs and sport versus religion. Less people care about going to religious services.
And where care is also about money, right? Care is also about money here, as in people work in these places.
But I would say, let's just think about the subjective states, right? So there's more people. If we aggregated the desire of the population, it would be weighted more towards going to sport, I would guess. And that's the way that most people, I think, would think, that it's all about the weight of preferences that are taking place within society, that are happening within society.
Or we could qualify that, because I think that may be the case that still quite a lot of Australians obviously go to, say, church on a Sunday and so on. So qualify that to say how many of them see that as a sort of necessary thing to do, even internally, as opposed to being online and this kind of thing, right?
So what I would say that we need to have a way of actually saying some preferences, even if they're felt... Sorry, there's a plane going over. I live under a light aircraft way thing, flight path. I think we need some way of saying.
No PS5, he lives under a flight path. It's the tales of day.
I know. What was I saying? Yes. So that we need to have some way of saying, actually, you can have a desire that is stronger but less relevant than a different desire. So like a religious desire, it's not the same kind of thing. So if you think about, for example, Aunt Bethel's getting really old, her health is failing, she desires to go to confession one last time so that she can die feeling as though her sins have been forgiven, or who knows, perhaps that her sins are in reality forgiven. Okay, that's one desire. And then there's another person who has this really, really maybe obsessive desire to go to a casino and gamble, right? And I would say that it doesn't matter how strongly those desires are felt, one is more legitimate than the other.
Okay, so yeah.
But our culture and our social order has no categories for distinguishing between or ranking those
desires.
That's
because I don't think you rank as between those. I think those are just different narratives, right? So you need to actually have an understanding that, because both of those are kind of architectonic. One is pointing to consumption as the end of life, and one is pointing to an understanding that pursuing God, love of God and neighbor is the end
of
life.
And I don't think that distinction is intelligible to most Australians.
But this is why you have to think, well, you know, how do you make it culturally intelligible and these kinds of things, right? So this goes into, we're going to talk about a little bit more about this when we talk about doubt. But I think it's a fascinating question. And it does mean, you know, I'm usually the one who's a bit more hopeful here, but this has given me a bit of a sense of like, oh gosh, I don't want to dismiss it, how difficult it is. But you know, so Milbank talks about, and I think it's an essay, Where is the Church? He talks about, you know, the need to narrate ecclesial happenings. And I think as a first point, if we think what's to be done, one is that we just need to be better at narrating ecclesial happenings. As in, what he means by that, he means, you know, where is the church to be found? Well, if the church is kind of the continuing of the incarnation of Christ himself, right? The body of Christ, Christ's bride. Then where does this take place and how does it take place? And I think there are numerous things that church has been doing. You know, my own rector gave us stories about how he was having to climb balconies to offer people last rites or to pray with them as they were sick and so on, you know, maintaining social distance and this kind of thing, right? I've heard of food banks in some churches that have like just had to explode in their usage to serve their communities. You know, there are multiple things happening, but we don't narrate these ecclesial happenings in particularly good form, right? No, we don't actually state them in order to say this is not just simply something done by a group of private individual co-religionists, but this is actually the very site of a real politics.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, I guess we're probably out of time.
We are out of time.
And we're going to continue this conversation, I think, into the next episode as we think about someone that has a much more positive vision.
Can we finish I wrote it down here because I thought it is Christmas.
Oh, yes.
It is Christmas, and I was feeling pretty grim when I was thinking about this episode we're doing. But then, you know, as the Archbishop of Canterbury in that speech I mentioned, he actually grounds that speech in this as well, the Magnificat, where it's, you know, he has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and the rich he has sent away empty. I mean, talk about SmackDown stuff, right? Like, you know, this is the reality of the tradition, the faith that we follow, right? And you think, how could it not be? How could it be anything other than deeply radical?
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Please like us on Facebook by searching The Eucatastrophe. Follow us on Twitter at UCAT, EUCAT _ podcast. And please share us around. We hope you have a really wonderful Christmas. I hope that you get to see some people and you have a sense of God's presence amongst us. In the person of Christ.
Or just a PS5.
We'll join you next week as we discuss Francis's Fratelli Tutti. We'll see you then. Bye.